Tom exploded as a topic as a result of other ape research. The central question became whether apes or children hold a theory about the minds of others. I have trouble with this terminology, too, because it makes it sound as if we understand others through a rational evaluation, not unlike the way we figure out physical processes, such as how water freezes or how continents drift apart. It sounds far too cerebral and disembodied. I seriously doubt that we or any other animal grasp the mental states of someone else at such an abstract level. Some even speak of mind-reading, a term reminiscent of the telepathic trickery of magicians. Let me guess what card you have in mind. The magician, however, operates entirely on the basis of which card he has seen you lay your eyes on, or some other visual cue, because there is no such thing as mind-reading. All we can do is figure out what others have seen, heard, or smelled, and deduce from their behavior what their next step may be. Putting all this information together is no minor feat and takes extensive experience, but it is body reading, not mind reading. It allows us to look at a situation from the viewpoint of another, which is why I prefer the term perspective taking. We use this capacity to our own advantage, but also to the advantage of others, such as when we respond to someone else's distress or fulfill the needs of another person. This obviously gets us closer to empathy than Tom. Human empathy is a critically important capacity, one that holds entire societies together and connects us with those whom we love and care about. It is far more fundamental to survival, I'd say, than knowing what others know. But since it belongs to the large, submerged part of the iceberg, traits that we share with all animals, it doesn't garner the same respect. Moreover, empathy sounds emotional, something cognitive science tends to look down upon. Never mind that knowing what others want or need, or how best to please or assist them, is likely the original perspective-taking, the kind from which all other kinds derive. It is essential for reproduction, since mammalian mothers need to be sensitive to the emotional states of their offspring when they are cold, hungry, or in danger. Empathy is a biological imperative. Empathic perspective-taking, defined by the father of economics, Adam Smith, as changing places in fancy with the sufferer, is well known outside of our species, including dramatic cases of apes, elephants, or dolphins helping one another under dire circumstances. Consider how an alpha male chimpanzee at a Swedish zoo saved the life of a juvenile. The juvenile had entangled himself in a rope and was choking to death. The male lifted him up, thus removing the rope's pressure, and carefully unwrapped the rope from his neck. He thus demonstrated an understanding of the suffocating effect of ropes and knew what to do about it. Had he pulled at the juvenile or the rope, he would only have made things worse. I speak of targeted helping, which is assistance based on an appreciation of the other's precise circumstances. One of the oldest reports in the scientific literature concerns an incident in 1954 off the coast of Florida. During a capture expedition for a public aquarium, a stick of dynamite was set off under the water surface near a pod of bottlenose dolphins. As soon as one stunned victim surfaced, heavily listing, two other dolphins came to its aid. One came up from below on each side, and placing the upper lateral parts of their heads approximately beneath the pectoral fins of the injured one, they buoyed it to the surface in an apparent effort to allow it to breathe while it remained partially stunned. The two helpers were submerged, which meant that they couldn't breathe during the entire effort. The pod remained nearby and waited until their companion recovered, after which they all fled in a hurry, taking tremendous leaps. Another case of targeted helping occurred one day at Booker's Zoo. After having cleaned the indoor hall and before releasing the chimps, the keepers hosed out all the rubber tires and hung them one by one on a horizontal log extending from the climbing frame. Upon seeing the tires, female Kroom wanted one in which some water remained. The chimps often use tires as vessels to drink from. Unfortunately, this particular tire was at the end of the row, with multiple heavy tires hanging in front of it. Kroom pulled and pulled at the one she wanted, but was unable to move it. She worked in vain on this problem for over 10 minutes, ignored by everyone except Yaki, a 7-year-old that she had taken care of as a juvenile. As soon as Kroom gave up and walked away, Yaki approached the scene. Without hesitation, he pushed the tires off the log one by one, beginning with the front one, followed by the second in the row, and so on, as any sensible chimp would. When he reached the last tire, he carefully removed it so that no water was spilled, and carried it straight to his aunt, placing it upright in front of her. Kroom accepted his present without any special acknowledgment, and was already scooping up water with her hand when Yaki left. Having gone over numerous incidents of insightful assistance in the Age of Empathy, I am pleased that there are now finally controlled experiments. For example, at the PRI where Ayumu lives, 2 chimps were placed side by side, while one had to guess what kind of tool the other needed to reach attractive food. The first chimp had a choice between a range of tools, such as a straw to suck up juice or a rake to move food closer, only one of which would work for her partner. She'd need to look at and judge her partner's situation before handing her the most useful tool through a window. This is indeed what the chimps did, showing a capacity to grasp the specific needs of others. The next question is, do primates recognize one another's internal states, such as the difference between a partner who is hungry and one who is sated? Would you give up precious food for someone who has just eaten a big meal right in front of you? This is the question Japanese primatologist Yuko Hattori asked the monkeys in our capuchin colony. Capuchins can be quite generous and are great social eaters, often sitting in clusters munching together. When a pregnant female hesitates to descend to the floor to collect her own fruits, being arboreal, these monkeys feel safer higher up. We have seen other monkeys grab more than they need and bring handfuls of food up to her. In the experiment, we separated 2 monkeys with a mesh wide enough to stick their arms through, while one of them received a small bucket with apple slices. Under these circumstances, the provisioned monkey often brings food to its empty-handed partner. They sit next to the mesh partition and let the other one reach through to take food out of their hands or mouth, sometimes actively pushing it in their direction. This is remarkable because the circumstances allow the possessor to avoid sharing altogether by staying away from the mesh. We found one exception to their generosity, however. If their partner had just eaten, the monkeys became stingy. Of course, this could be due to a sated partner being less interested in food, but the monkeys were stingy only if they had actually seen their partner eat. A partner that had been fed out of sight was treated as generously as any other. Yuko concluded that the monkeys judged the need, or lack thereof, of their companions based on what they had seen them eat. In children, an understanding of needs and desires develops years before they realize what others know. They read hearts well before they read minds. This suggests that we are on the wrong track in phrasing all this in terms of abstract thinking and theories about others. At a young age, children recognize, for example, that a child looking for his rabbit will be happy to find it, whereas a child searching for his dog will be indifferent to the rabbit. They have an understanding of what others want. Not all humans take advantage of this capacity, which is why we have 2 kinds of gift givers: those who go out of their way to find a gift that you might like, and those who arrive with what they like. Even birds do better than that. In one of those cognitive ripples typical of our field, empathic perspective taking has been suggested for corvids. Male Eurasian jays court their mates by feeding them delicious tidbits. On the assumption that every male likes to impress, experimenters give him two foods to choose from, wax moth larvae and mealworms. But before giving the male a chance to feed his mate, they would feed her first with one of those two foods. Seeing this, the male would change his choice. If his mate had just eaten a lot of wax moth larvae, he'd pick mealworms for her instead, and vice versa. He did so, however, only if he had witnessed her being fed by the experimenter. Male birds thus took into account what their mate had just eaten, perhaps assuming that she'd be ready for a change of taste. Jays, too, may attribute preferences to others, taking another's point of view. At this point, you may wonder why perspective-taking was never declared uniquely human. For this, we need to look at a series of ingenious experiments in the 1990s in which chimpanzees could gain information about concealed food either from an experimenter who had witnessed the hiding process or from another one who had been put in the corner with a bucket over his head. Obviously, they should ignore the second experimenter who had no idea and follow the directions of the first. They made no distinction, however. Or an ape could beg for cookies from an experimenter sitting out of reach with a blindfold over his eyes. Would the chimps understand that there is no point stretching out an open hand to someone who cannot see them? After a great variety of such tests, the conclusion was that chimpanzees fail to understand the knowledge that others have and don't even realize that knowing requires seeing. It was a most peculiar conclusion, given that the main researcher himself relates how playful apes put buckets or blankets over their heads and walk around until they bump into each other. When he himself put things over his head, however, he immediately became the target of play attacks by these apes, who exploited his obscured vision. They knew he couldn't see them, and tried to catch him by surprise. I knew a couple of juvenile male chimps who loved to throw rocks at us, practicing their impressive long-range aim, invariably doing so as soon as I moved my camera to my eye, which made me lose visual contact. Such behavior alone tells us that apes know something about the vision of others, and that tests with blindfolds must therefore be missing something. But as happens so often among experimentalists, behavior in the testing room was given priority over real-life observations. As a result, human exceptionalism was loudly proclaimed, most dramatically, by concluding that apes do not possess anything remotely resembling a Tom. This conclusion was warmly greeted and is still being broadcast today, even though it is not held up to scrutiny. At my home institution, the Yerkes Primate Center, David Levins and Bill Hopkins conducted tests in which they placed a banana outside a chimpanzee enclosure where humans regularly walked by. Would the chimps draw attention to get people to hand them the fruit? Would they distinguish between people who could see them and those who could not? If so, this would suggest that they grasped another individual's visual perspective. The chimps did, because they'd give visual signals to people who looked in their direction, but they'd vocalize and bang on metal if people failed to notice them. They even pointed at the banana to clarify their wishes. One chimpanzee, afraid to be misunderstood, pointed first with her hand at the banana and then with a finger at her own mouth. Intentional signaling is not limited to captive apes, as became clear when scientists put a fake snake on the path of wild chimpanzees. Recording the apes' alarm calls in a Ugandan forest, they found that calling is not just a reflection of fear, because the chimps vocalize regardless of whether the snake is near or far. It is rather a warning intended for others. They call more when others are present, especially friends who have failed to notice the serpent. Callers look back and forth between nearby chimps and the danger, calling more to companions who are naive about it than to those who already know. Callers thus specifically inform those who lack knowledge, likely because they realize how knowing requires seeing. A critical test of this connection was conducted by Brian Hare, then a student here at the Yerkes Primate Center. Brian wanted to know if apes exploit information about another's visual input. A low-ranking individual was enticed to pick up food in front of a high-ranking one. This is a tricky thing to do, and most subordinates shy away from the confrontation. They were offered a choice between pieces of food that the dominant individual had seen being hidden and pieces hidden without him knowing. The subordinate, on the other hand, had watched it all. In an open competition, like an Easter egg hunt, the safest bet for the subordinate would be to pick only those food items that the dominant had no clue about. This is exactly what they did, showing that they understood that if the dominant had not seen the hiding process, he couldn't know. Brian's study threw the question of Animal Tom wide open again. In an unexpected twist, one capuchin monkey at the University of Kyoto and several macaques at a Dutch research center recently passed similar tasks. This is why the whole notion that visual perspective taking is limited to our species is now in the trash bin. Each of the above experiments, in and of itself, may not be entirely watertight, but taken together, they come down on the side of perspective taking abilities in other species. It is a testimony to Menzel's pioneering work that we keep hiding food, or snakes, and pitting guessers against knowers. It remains the classical paradigm to assess these capacities both in humans and in other species. Perhaps most telling is an experiment by Menzel's son, Charles. Like his father, Charlie Menzel is a deep thinker, unsatisfied with easy tests or simple answers. At the Language Research Center here in Atlanta, he'd let a female chimp named Pansy watch while he hid food in the pine forest around her outdoor enclosure. Charlie would dig a small hole in the ground to put a bag of M&Ms into it, or place a candy bar in the bushes. Pansy would follow the process from behind bars. Since she could not go where Charlie was, she would need human help to eventually get the hidden food. Sometimes Charlie would hide it after all other people had gone for the day. This meant Pansy could not communicate with anybody about what she knew until the next morning. When the caretakers arrived, they were unaware of the experiment. Pansy first had to get their attention, then provide information to someone who had no clue as to what she was talking about. During a live demonstration of Pansy's skills, Charlie told me that caretakers generally have a higher opinion of apes' mental abilities than does the typical philosopher or psychologist. This high opinion was essential for his experiment, he explained, because it meant that Pansy was dealing with people who took her seriously. All those recruited by Pansy said they were at first surprised by her behavior, but soon understood what she wanted them to do. By following her pointing, beckoning, panting, and calling, they had no trouble finding the candies hidden in the forest. Without her instructions, they would never have known where to look. Pansy never pointed in the wrong direction or to locations that had been used on previous occasions. The result was communication about a past event present in the ape's memory to ignorant members of a different species. If the human followed the instructions correctly and got closer to the food, Pansy would vigorously bob her head in affirmation, like, yes, yes, and like us, she'd lift her hand up, giving higher points if the item was farther away. She realized that she knew something that the other didn't know, and was intelligent enough to recruit humans as willing slaves to obtain the goodies of her desire. Just to illustrate how creative chimps can be in this regard, here is a typical incident at our field station. A young female grunted at me from behind a fence and kept looking at me with shiny eyes, indicating she knew something exciting, alternated with pointing stares into the grass near my feet. I couldn't figure out what she wanted until she spat. From the trajectory, I noticed a small green grape. When I gave it to her, she ran to another spot and repeated her performance. Having memorized the locations of fruits dropped by the caretakers, she proved an accurate spitter, collecting 3 rewards this way. Clever Hans in reverse. So why did we at first reach the wrong conclusion about animal perspective taking, and why has it happened so many times before and since? Claims about absent capacities range from the idea that primates do not care about the welfare of others, do not imitate, or even fail to understand gravity. Imagine this for flightless animals that travel high above the ground. In my own career, I have faced resistance to the notion that primates reconcile after fights or console those who are distressed. Or at least I heard the counterclaim that they do not truly do so, as in they do not truly imitate or truly console, which immediately gets one into debates about how to distinguish what looks like consolation or imitation from the real thing. At times, the overwhelming negativity got to me, as an entire literature burgeoned that was more excited about the cognitive deficits of other species than about their actual accomplishments. It would be like having a career advisor who all the time tells you that you are too dumb for this or too dumb for that. What a depressing attitude. The fundamental problem with all these denials is that it is impossible to prove a negative. This is no minor issue. When anyone claims the absence of a given capacity in another species and speculates that it must therefore have arisen recently in our lineage, we hardly need to inspect the data to appreciate the shakiness of such a claim. All we can ever conclude with some certainty is that we have failed to find a given skill in the species that we have examined. We cannot go much further than this, and we certainly may not turn it into an affirmation of absence. Scientists do so all the time, though, whenever the human-animal comparison is at stake. The zeal to find out what sets us apart overrides all reasonable caution. Not even with regard to the monster of Loch Ness or the abominable snowman will you ever hear anyone claim to have proven its non-existence, even though this would fit the expectations of most of us. And why do governments still spend billions of dollars to search for extraterrestrial civilizations while there is no shred of evidence to encourage this quest? Isn't it time to conclude once and for all that these civilizations simply don't exist? But this conclusion will never be reached. That respected psychologists ignore the recommendation to tread lightly around absent evidence is most puzzling, therefore. One reason is that they test apes and children in the same manner, at least in their minds, while coming up with contrary results. Applying a battery of cognitive tasks to both apes and children, and finding not a single result in the apes' favor, they tout the differences as proof of human uniqueness. Otherwise, why didn't the apes fare better? To understand the flaw in this logic, we need to go back to Clever Hans, the counting horse. But instead of using Hans to illustrate why animal capacities are sometimes overrated, this time we are concerned with the unfair advantage that human capacities enjoy. The outcome of ape-child comparisons themselves suggests the answer. When tested on physical tasks, such as memory, causality, and the use of tools, apes perform at about the same level as 2.5-year-old children. But when it comes to social skills, such as learning from others or following others' signals, they are left in the dust. Social problem-solving requires interaction with an experimenter, however, whereas physical problem-solving does not. This raises the possibility that the human interface is key. The typical format of an experiment is to let apes interact with a white-coated, barely familiar human. Since experimenters are supposed to be bland and neutral, they do not engage in schmoozing, petting, or other niceties. This doesn't help make the ape feel at ease and identify with the experimenter. Children, however, are encouraged to do so. Moreover, only the children are interacting with a member of their own species, which helps them even more. Nevertheless, experimenters comparing apes and children insist that all their subjects are treated exactly the same. The inherent bias of this arrangement has become harder to ignore, however, now that we know more about ape attitudes. A recent eye-tracking study, which precisely measured where subjects looked, reached the unsurprising conclusion that apes consider members of their own species special. They follow the gaze of another ape more closely than they follow the human gaze. This may be all we need to explain why apes fare poorly on social tasks presented by members of our species. There are only a dozen institutes that test ape cognition, and I have visited most of them. I have noticed procedures in which humans barely interact with their subjects, and ones in which they have close physical contact. The latter can safely be done only by those who raised the apes themselves, or have at least known them since infancy. Since apes are much stronger than we are, and have been known to kill people, the up-close and personal approach is not for everyone. The other extreme derives from the traditional approach in the psychology lab, carrying a rat or a pigeon into a testing room with as little contact as possible. The ideal here is a non-existent experimenter, meaning the absence of any personal relation. In some labs, apes are called into a room and given only a few minutes to perform before they are sent out again without any playful or friendly contact. Almost like a military drill. Imagine if children were tested under such circumstances. How would they fare? At our center in Atlanta, all our chimps are reared by their own kind, and so are more ape than human-oriented. They are chimpy, as we say, relative to apes that have less social background or were raised by humans. We never share the same space with them, but we do interact through the bars, and we always play or groom before testing. We talk to them to put them at ease, give them goodies, and in general try to create a relaxed atmosphere. We want them to look upon our tasks as a game rather than as work, and certainly never put them under pressure. If they are tense because of events in their group, or because another chimp is banging on the outside door or hooting his lungs out, we wait until everyone is calmed down, or we reschedule the test. There is no point testing apes who are not ready. If such procedures are not followed, apes may act as if they don't understand the problem at hand, whereas the real issue is high anxiety and distraction. Many negative results in the literature may be explained this way. The methodology sections of scientific papers rarely offer a look in the kitchen, but I think it is crucial. My own approach has always been to be firm and friendly. Firm, meaning that we are consistent and don't make capricious demands, but also don't let the animals walk all over us, such as when they only want to play around and get free sweets. But we are also friendly, without punishment, anger, or attempts to dominate. The latter still happens all too often in experiments and is counterproductive with such headstrong animals. Why would an ape follow the points and prompts of a human experimenter whom he sees as a rival? This is another potential source of negative outcomes. My own team typically cajoles, bribes, and sweet-talks its primate partners. Sometimes I feel like a motivational speaker, such as when Peony, one of our oldest females, ignored a task that we had set up for her. For 20 minutes she lay in the corner. I sat down right next to her and told her in a calm voice that I didn't have all day and it would be great if she could get going. She slowly got up, glancing at me, and strolled to the next room, where she sat down for the task. Of course, as discussed in the previous chapter in relation to Robert Yerkes, it is unlikely that Peony followed the details of what I had said. She was sensitive to my tone of voice and knew all along what we wanted. However good our relations with apes, the idea that we can test them in exactly the same way as we test children is an illusion of the same order as someone throwing both fish and cats into a swimming pool and believing he is treating them the same way. Think of the children as the fish. While testing them, psychologists smile and talk all the time, giving instructions where to look or what to do. Look at the little froggy. Tells a child so much more than an ape will ever know about the green plastic blob in your hand. Moreover, children are usually tested with a parent in the room, often sitting on their lap. Having permission to run around and an experimenter of their own species, they have an enormous leg up over the ape sitting behind bars without verbal hints or parental support. True, developmental psychologists try to reduce the influence of parents by telling them not to talk or point, and they may give them sunglasses or a baseball cap to cover their eyes. These measures, however, reveal their woeful underestimation of the power of a parent's motivation to see their child succeed. When it comes to their precious offspring, few people care about the objective truth. We can be glad that Oscar Fungst designed far more rigorous controls while examining clever Hans. In fact, Fungst found that the wide-rimmed hat of the horse owner greatly benefited Hans, since hats amplify head movements. In the same way that the owner vociferously denied his effect on the horse, even after it had been proven, parents of children may be completely honest about suppressing cues, but adults have far too many ways to unintentionally guide the choices of a child on their lap. Through slight body movements, gaze direction, halted breathing, sighs, squeezes, strokes, and whispered encouragements. Letting parents attend the testing of a child is asking for trouble. The sort of trouble we avoid in animal testing. The American primatologist Alan Gardner, who was first to teach American Sign Language to an ape, discussed human biases under the heading Pygmalion Leading. Pygmalion, in ancient mythology, was a Cypriot sculptor who fell in love with his own statue of a woman. The story has been used as a metaphor of how teachers raise the performance of certain children by expecting the world of them. They fall in love with their own prediction, which serves as a self-fulfilling prophecy. Remember how Charlie Menzel felt that only people who hold apes in high esteem will fully appreciate what they are trying to communicate. His was a plea for raised expectations, which, unfortunately, is not the situation apes typically face. Children, in contrast, are treated in such a nurturing manner that they inevitably confirm the mental superiority ascribed to them. Experimenters admire and stimulate them from the outset, making them feel like fish in the water, whereas they often treat apes more like albino rats, keeping them at a distance and in the dark, while depriving them of the verbal encouragement we offer members of our own species. Needless to say, I view most ape-child comparisons as fatally flawed. Recall that apes have been tested for Tom by having them guess what humans know or don't know. The problem here is that captive apes have every reason to believe that we are omniscient. Suppose my assistant calls to tell me that Sacco, the alpha male, has been wounded in a fight. I head over to the field station, walk up to him, and ask him to turn around, which he does, having known me since he was a baby, to show me his behind with the gash. Now try to look at this from Sacco's perspective. Chimps are smart animals, always trying to figure out what's going on. Of course, he wonders how I know about his injury. I must be an all-knowing god. As such, human experimenters are about the last to be used to find out if apes understand the connection between seeing and knowing. All we are testing is the ape's theory of the human mind. It is no accident that we made substantial progress only after egg hunt scenarios pitted apes against other apes. One area of cognitive research that has been lucky to escape the species barrier is the study of Tom in animals that are so different from us that everyone understands that humans are unsuitable partners. This has been the case with corvids. Since a true animal watcher never takes a break, the British ethologist Nicky Clayton made a major discovery over lunch at the University of California at Davis. While sitting at an outdoor terrace, she saw western scrub jays fly off with scraps stolen from the tables. They not only cached them, but also guarded them against thieves. If another bird saw where they hid their food, it was bound to disappear. Clayton noticed that after their rivals left the scene, many of the jays returned to rebury their treasures. In follow-up research with Nathan Emery in their lab at Cambridge, she let jays cache mealworms either in private or while being watched by another jay. Given a chance, the jays quickly recached their worms at a new location, but only if they had been watched. They seemed to understand that the food was safe if no other birds had any information. Moreover, only birds who themselves had pilfered others' food recached their own. Following the dictum, "It takes a thief to know a thief," the jays seemed to extrapolate from their own criminality to that of others. Again, we recognize the Menzel-like design of this experiment, which is even more obvious in a study of perspective-taking ravens. The Austrian zoologist Thomas Bugnjar had a low-ranking male who was expert at opening canisters that contained goodies, but this male often lost his prize to a bullying and stealing dominant male. The low-ranking male, however, learned to distract his competitor by enthusiastically opening empty containers and making as if to eat from them. When the dominant bird found out, he got very angry and started throwing things around. Bugnjar further found out that when ravens approach hidden food, they take into account what other ravens know. If their competitors have the same knowledge, they hurry to get there first, but if the others are ignorant, they take their time. All in all, animals do plenty of perspective taking, from being aware of what others want to knowing what others know. A few frontiers are left, of course, such as whether they recognize when others have the wrong knowledge. In humans, researchers test this issue with the so-called false belief task. But since these refinements are hard to evaluate without language, we face a dearth of animal data. Still, even if the remaining differences hold up, there is little doubt that the blanket assertion that Tom is uniquely human must be downgraded to a more nuanced, gradualist view. Humans probably possess a fuller understanding of one another, but the contrast with other animals is not stark enough that extraterrestrials would automatically pick Tom as the chief marker that sets us apart. While this conclusion is based on solid data from repeated experiments, let me add one anecdote that captures the phenomenon in an entirely different way. At the Yerkes Field Station, where apes live in grassy open-air enclosures in the warm Georgia weather, I developed a special bond with an exceptionally bright female chimp named Lolita. One day, Lolita had a new baby, and I wanted to get a good look at it. This is hard to do, since a newborn ape is really no more than a little dark blob against its mother's dark tummy. I called Lolita out of her grooming huddle, high up in the climbing frame, and pointed at her belly as soon as she sat down in front of me. Looking at me, she took the infant's right hand in her right hand, and its left hand in her left hand. It sounds simple, but given that the baby was ventrally clinging to her, she had to cross her arms to do so. The movement resembled that of people crossing their arms when grabbing a t-shirt by its hems in order to take it off. She then slowly lifted the baby into the air while turning it around its axis, unfolding it in front of me. Suspended from its mother's hands, the baby now faced me instead of her. After it made a few grimaces and whimpers, infants hate to lose touch with a warm belly, Lolita quickly tucked it back into her lap. With this elegant motion, Lolita demonstrated that she realized I would find the front of her newborn more interesting than its back. To take someone else's perspective represents a huge leap in social evolution. Spreading habits. Decades ago, friends of mine were outraged by a newspaper article that ranked the smartest canine breeds. They happened to own the breed that was dead last on the list, the Afghan Hound. Naturally, the top breed was the Border Collie. My insulted friends argued that the only reason Afghans were considered dim-witted is that they are independent-minded, stubborn, and unwilling to follow orders. The newspaper's list was about obedience, they said, not intelligence. Afghans are perhaps more like cats, which are not beholden to anyone. This is no doubt why some people rate cats as less intelligent than dogs. We know, however, that a cat's lack of response to humans is not due to ignorance. A recent study showed that felines have no trouble recognizing their owner's voice. The deeper problem is that they don't care, prompting the study's authors to add, "The behavioral aspects of cats that cause their owners to become attached to them are still undetermined." I had to think of this story when dog cognition emerged as a hot topic. Dogs were depicted as smarter than wolves, perhaps even apes, because they paid better attention to human pointing gestures. A human would point at one out of two buckets, and the dog would check that particular bucket out for a reward. Scientists concluded that domestication had given dogs extra intelligence compared to their ancestors. But what does it mean that wolves fail to follow human pointing? With a brain about one-third larger than a dog's, I bet a wolf could outsmart its domestic counterpart any time, yet all we go by is how they react to us. And who says that the difference in reaction is inborn, a consequence of domestication, and not based on familiarity with the species doing the pointing? It is the old nature-nurture dilemma. The only way to determine how much of a trait is produced by genes and how much by the environment is to hold one of these two constant, to see what difference the other one makes. It is a complex problem that is never fully resolved. In the dog-wolf comparison, this would mean raising wolves like dogs in a human household. If they still differ, genetics might be at play. Raising wolf puppies in the home is a hellish job, though, since they are exceptionally energetic and less rule-bound than dog puppies, chewing up everything in sight. When dedicated scientists raised wolves this way, the nurture hypothesis came out the winner. Human-raised wolves followed hand points as well as dogs. A few differences persisted, though, such as that wolves looked less at human faces than dogs and were more self-reliant. When dogs tackle a problem they cannot solve, they look back at their human companion to get encouragement or assistance, something that wolves never do. Wolves keep trying and trying on their own. Domestication may be responsible for this particular difference. Instead of intelligence, though, it seems more a question of temperament and relations with us, those weird bipedal apes that the wolf evolved to fear and the dog was bred to please. Dogs, for example, engage in lots of eye contact with us. They have hijacked the human parental pathways in the brain, making us care about them in almost the same way that we care about our children. Dog owners who stare into their pet's eyes experience a rapid increase in oxytocin, a neuropeptide involved in attachment and bonding. Exchanging gazes full of empathy and trust, we enjoy a special relationship with the dog. Cognition requires attention and motivation, yet it cannot be reduced to either. As we have seen, the same problem troubles the comparison between apes and children, an issue that popped up again in the controversy around animal culture. Whereas in the 19th century anthropologists were still open to the possibility of culture outside our own species, in the 20th they began to write culture with a capital C, while claiming that the trait is what makes us human. Sigmund Freud considered culture and civilization a victory over nature, while the American anthropologist Leslie White, in a book ironically entitled The Evolution of Culture, declared, "Man and culture originated simultaneously. This by definition." Naturally, when the first reports of animal culture came along, defined as habits learned from others, from potato-washing macaques and nut-cracking chimpanzees to bubble-net-hunting humpback whales, they faced a wall of hostility. One line of defense against this offensive notion was to focus on the learning mechanism. If it could be shown that human culture relies on distinct mechanisms, so the thinking went, we might be able to claim culture for ourselves. Imitation became the holy grail of this battle. To this end, the age-old definition of imitating as doing an act from seeing it done had to be changed to something narrower, something more advanced. The category true imitation was born, which requires one individual to intentionally copy another's specific technique to achieve a specific goal. Merely duplicating behavior, such as one songbird learning another's song, was not enough anymore. It had to be done with insight and comprehension. While imitation is common in lots of animals, according to the old definition, true imitation is rare. We learned this fact from experiments in which apes and children were prompted to imitate an experimenter. They'd watch a human model open a puzzle box or rake in food with a tool. While the children copied the demonstrated action, the apes failed, hence the conclusion that other species lack imitative capacities and cannot possibly have culture. The comfort this finding brought to some circles greatly puzzled me, because it did not answer any fundamental questions either about animal culture or about human culture. All it did was draw a flimsy line in the sand. One can see here the interplay between the redefinition of a phenomenon and the quest to know what sets us apart, but also a deeper methodological problem, because whether apes imitate us or not is wholly beside the point. For culture to arise in a species, all that matters is that its members pick up habits from one another. There are only two ways to make a fair comparison in this regard, if we disregard the third option of having white-coated apes administer tests to both apes and children. One is to follow the wolf example, raise apes in a human home so that they are as comfortable as children around a human experimenter. The second is the so-called conspecific approach, which is to test a species with models of its own kind. The first solution yielded results right away, because several human-raised apes turned out to be as good at imitating members of our species as were young children. In other words, apes, like children, are born imitators and prefer to copy the species that raised them. Under most circumstances, this will be their own kind, but if reared by another species, they are prepared to imitate that one as well. Using us as models, these apes spontaneously learn to brush their teeth, ride bicycles, light fires, drive golf carts, eat with a knife and fork, peel potatoes, and mop the floor. It reminds me of suggestive stories on the internet about dogs raised by cats, which show feline behavior such as sitting in boxes, crawling under tight spaces, licking their paws to clean their face, or sitting with their front legs tucked in. Another critical study was conducted by Victoria Horner, a Scottish primatologist, who later became my team's lead expert on cultural learning. Together with Andrew Whiten of St. Andrews University, Vicky worked with a dozen orphan chimps at Ngamba Island, a sanctuary in Uganda. She acted like a mix between a mother and caretaker for the juvenile apes. Sitting next to her during tests, the juvenile apes were attached to Vicky and eager to follow her example. Her experiment created waves because, as in Ayumu's case, the apes proved to be smarter than the children. Vicky would poke a stick into holes in a large plastic box, going through a series of holes until a candy would roll out. Only one hole mattered. If the box was made of black plastic, it was impossible to tell that some of the holes were just for show. A transparent box, on the other hand, made it obvious where the candies came from. Handed the stick and the box, the young chimps mimicked only the necessary moves, at least with the transparent box. The children, on the other hand, mimicked everything that Vicky had demonstrated, including useless moves. They did so even with the transparent box, approaching the problem more like a magic ritual than as a goal-directed task. With this outcome, the whole strategy of redefining imitation backfired. After all, it was the apes who best fit the new definition of true imitation. The apes were showing selective imitation, the sort that pays close attention to goals and methods. If imitation requires understanding, we have to give it to the apes, not to the children, who, for lack of a better term, showed only dumb copying. What to do now? Premack complained that it was way too easy to make children look foolish, as if that were the goal of the experiment, whereas in reality he felt there must be something wrong with the interpretation. His distress was genuine, showing to what degree the human ego gets in the way of dispassionate science. Promptly, psychologists settled on a narrative in which over-imitation, a new term for children's indiscriminate copying, is actually a brilliant achievement. It fits our species' purported reliance on culture, because it makes us imitate behavior regardless of what it is good for. We transmit habits in full, without every individual making his or her own ill-informed decisions. Given the superior knowledge of adults, the best strategy for a child is to copy them without question. Blind faith is the only truly rational strategy. It was concluded with some relief. Even more striking were Vicky's studies at our field station in Atlanta, where we started a decade-long research program in collaboration with Whiten, focusing entirely on the conspecific approach. When chimps were given a chance to watch one another, incredible talents for imitation manifested themselves. Apes truly do ape, allowing behavior to be faithfully transmitted within the group. A video of Katie imitating her mother, Georgia, offers a nice example. Georgia had learned to flip open a little door in a box, then stick a rod deep into the opening to retrieve a reward. Katie had watched her mother do this 5 times, following her every move and smelling Georgia's mouth every time she got a reward. After her mother was moved to another room, Katie could finally access the box herself. Even before we had added any rewards, she flipped open the door with one hand and inserted the rod with the other. Sitting like this, she looked up at us on the other side of the window and impatiently rapped it while grunting, as if to tell us to hurry up. As soon as we pushed the reward into the box, she retrieved it. Before ever being rewarded for these actions, Katie perfectly duplicated the sequence she had watched Georgia perform. Rewards are often secondary. Imitation without reward is, of course, common in human culture, such as when we mimic hairstyles, accents, dance steps, and hand gestures. But it is also common in the rest of the primate order. The macaques on the Arashiyama mountaintop in Japan customarily rub pebbles together. The young learn to do it without any reward other than perhaps the noise associated with it. If one case refutes the common notion that imitation requires reward, it is this weird behavior, about which Michael Huffman, an American primatologist who has studied it for decades, notes, "It is likely that the infant is first exposed in utero to the click-clacking sounds of stones as its mother plays, and then exposed visually as one of the first activities it sees after birth, when its eyes begin to focus on objects around it." The word fashion was first used in relation to animals by Cooler, whose apes invented new games all the time. They'd march, single file, around and around a post, trotting in the same rhythm with emphasis on one stamping foot, while the other foot stepped lightly, wagging their heads in the same rhythm, all acting in synchrony, as if in a trance. For months, our own chimps had a game we called cooking. They'd dig a hole in the dirt, collect water by holding a bucket under a faucet, and dump water into the hole. They'd sit around the hole, poking in the mud with a stick, as if stirring soup. Sometimes there were three or four such holes in operation at the same time, keeping half the group busy. At a chimpanzee sanctuary in Zambia, scientists followed the spread of yet another meme. One female was the first to stick a straw of grass into her ear, letting it hang out while walking around and grooming others. Over the years, other chimps followed her example, with several of them adopting the same new look. Fashions come and go in chimps, as in humans, but some habits we find in only one group and not in another. Typical is the hand-clasp grooming of some wild chimpanzee communities, in which two individuals hold hands above their heads while grooming each other's armpits with their other hands. Since habits and fashions often spread without any associated rewards, social learning is truly social. It is about conformity instead of payoffs. Thus, an infant male chimp may mimic the charging display of the alpha male who always bangs a specific metal door to accentuate his performance. 10 minutes after the male has finished his performance, a dangerous activity during which mothers keep their children near, the little son is let go. With all his hair on end, he goes to bang on the same door as his role model. Having documented numerous such examples, I developed the idea of bonding and identification-based observational learning, BIOL. Accordingly, primate social learning stems from an urge to belong. BIOL refers to conformism born from the desire to act like others and to fit in. It explains why apes imitate their own kind far better than the average human, and why among humans they imitate only those whom they feel close to. It also explains why young chimps, especially females, learn so much from their mothers, and why high-status individuals are favorite models. This preference is also known in our own societies, in which advertisements feature celebrities showing off watches, perfumes, and cars. We love to emulate the Beckhams, Kardashians, Biebers, and Jolies. Might the same apply to apes? In one experiment, Vicky spread brightly colored plastic chips around in an enclosure, which the chimps could collect and carry to a container in exchange for rewards. Exposed to the sight of a top-ranking group member trained to drop tokens into one container, and a bottom-ranking one trained to use a different container, the colony massively followed in the footsteps of the more prestigious member. As evidence mounted regarding imitation in apes, other species inevitably joined the ranks, showing similar capacities. There are now compelling studies on imitation in monkeys, dogs, corvids, parrots, and dolphins. And if we take a broader view, we have even more species to consider, because cultural transmission is widespread. To return to dogs and wolves, a recent experiment applied the conspecific approach to canine imitation. Instead of following human instructions, both dogs and wolves saw a member of their own species manipulate a lever to open the lid of a box with hidden food. Next, they were allowed to try the same box themselves. This time, the wolves greatly outsmarted the dogs. Wolves may be poor at following human pointing, but when it comes to picking up hints from their own kind, they beat dogs. The investigators ascribe this contrast to attention rather than cognition. They point out that wolves watch one another more closely as they rely on the pack for survival, whereas dogs rely on us. Clearly, it is time for us to start testing animals in accordance with their biology and move away from human-centric approaches. Instead of making the experimenter the chief model or partner, we better keep him or her in the background. Only by testing apes with apes, wolves with wolves, and children with human adults can we evaluate social cognition in its original evolutionary context. The one exception may be the dog, which we domesticated, or which domesticated itself, as some believe, to bond with us. Humans testing dog cognition may actually be a natural thing to do. Moratorium. Having escaped the Dark Ages, in which animals were mere stimulus response machines, we are free to contemplate their mental lives. It is a great leap forward, the one that Griffin fought for. But now that animal cognition is an increasing